This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for June 2009. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. Each month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature a few poems and talk about an article in the upcoming issue.
This month, we're going to hear poetry from Avril Curdy.
Because the spectacle of suffering corrupts us, all punishments are now executive, off stage.
And from Michael Hoffman.
You are good value at cocktail parties for about 5 minutes.
And we're also going to talk with Tom Slay about sex, drugs, and the late poet Tom Gunn.
The acid experience was very, very valuable to him because he learned all kinds of, as he said, unpleasant things about himself.
Before we hear the poets read their poems, we often like to highlight some other poems in the issue.
Yeah, we have a bunch of poems in here that are by some familiar folks and some new folks. Among them are A.E. Stallings, W.S. DiPiero, P.K. Page, Angie Malenko, Donald Revelle. But we thought we'd talk about a couple poems in particular this time, as always. And one of them is by Ray Armantrout, and the other is by D. Nirksi.
One of the poems that I especially liked by D. Nirksi is called A Marriage in the Dolomites. It's a short poem and seems to be a couple on vacation. It doesn't need much introduction. This is A Marriage in the Dolomites. We communicated by cheeses, unwrapping them gingerly, parting the crust with a fork, tasting dew, must, salt, raising an eyebrow. Or we let Chianti talk for us, rolling it in the glass, staring. It was dark and shiny as the pupil and stared back. Or we undressed each other. We took long walks hand in hand in the vineyards, the pastures, resenting each other bitterly for our happiness that excluded us as surely as the world did, mountain after mountain. It seems like it's a straightforward love poem, and it is a love poem in a way, but then in the end it says something very profound about consciousness. I wouldn't have thought of it in these terms, that amid great happiness you could resent each other for your happiness, that somehow that your own happiness could exclude you from it.
Yeah, that's the real subtext. I mean, in a literal sense, because it has an arresting beginning. We communicated by cheeses,
yeah,
unwrapping them gingerly, and the Chianti talks for us, rolling it in the glass, staring. So there's all this sensual information that's being exchanged between these lovers, and it's in this much larger setting
of estrangement.
And estrangement,
it's not, yeah, it's not a, it's an existential estrangement, but it's not an anguished existential mm-hmm. estrangement. They are making contact and somehow breaching this abyss, and yet the abyss is acknowledged, and the abyss is consciousness in a way,
which is part of their marriage. And what's really interesting about the way this poem is put together is that kind of in the middle there, you get that offhand line, or we undressed each other. And it's not the fulcrum for the poem. It's not made up into some big erotic moment.
Quite
it's
the
actually,
opposite.
Yeah.
Quite the opposite.
Yeah. And it's really true, too. It's the experience, not just of the erotic and the touching and feeling, but the whole world around a pair of lovers, that the whole world is present also in that relationship.
You also love this poem, Eyes, by Ray Armantrout, didn't you?
Yes. It's called Eyes, after John Milton. Our light is never spent, is spent. Thus have we scooped out maceration reservoirs. We will blaze forth what remains as pixels. Great angels fly at our behest between towers, along axons and dendrites, so that things stand as they stand in the recruited present.
So this is from that sonnet, right? The well-known sonnet by Milton.
The sonnet on his
right.
blindness.
Right.
Which starts out, when I consider how my light is spent, ere half my days in this dark world and wide. And the way that sonnet ends is with these famous lines about the angels who are at God's command, thousands at his bidding speed, the poem goes, and post or land an ocean without rest, they also serve who only stand and wait. So Ray Armantrout gets that word stand from the ending of this poem. And in the Milton poem, that kind of standing and waiting actually means something like being attentive and expectant. It's about being ready to do something because these angels are recruited in the sense that Armantrout's poem says. The angels in her poem, though, are contemporary angels. They fly at our behest, she says, between towers, which invokes for everybody at this point, I think, the World Trade Center towers.
Yeah, it's hard not to. And then that word recruited at the end takes on a different meaning if you think of recruited bombers. Or
maybe it's an updating of a kind of theological battle that a poet perceives, so that for Milton, there's a paradox that on the one hand, God needs people on earth to engage in the work of his kingdom, and at the same time, the feeling was that God didn't need anything. What we've inherited, or how all this has been transformed in the contemporary world, is that people are recruited to do battle on this earth on behalf of whatever their conception of God is, and this is affecting everybody around the world. So I just think this poem is trying to keep us up to date on that struggle.
Do you take the poem to be a rebuke to Milton? Like the beginning, our light is never spent, and then the immediate line is spent.
It may be a rebuke. I'm just guessing that, and I like having to guess, that it's a sad rebuke. So that for Milton, even in the darkness of his blindness, there was light. There was the light of God's kingdom. There was the light with which he could still see his wife. And in that kind of sense, there is a light which is never spent. But I feel that in Ray Armantrout's poem, we spend so many things. We spend everything in contemporary life. And so that even light is spent. If you think of the cost of the electricity or the effort involved in doing the terrible things that are done every day, we are spending and spending light and so much else.
At the beginning of the June issue are three poems from Avril Curdy. We've published a lot of her poems over the years and some of her prose as well. She's a wonderful critic, too. And her poems they're intellectual and sensuous in equal degrees. I know that her favorite poet is John Donne, and mm-hmm. that's a pretty good exemplar for her because of the way his poems move between thought and feeling so seamlessly, as T.S. Eliot said.
Well, the poem we're going to hear now is called To the Voice of the Retired Warden of Huntsville Prison, Texas Death Chamber. Texas leads all the other states in the number of executions done since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976, and many have taken place in Huntsville in eastern Texas.
And notice that it's to the voice of, not simply to the retired warden. Curdy explains that she encountered this warden as a voice on the radio one night as she was falling asleep.
The retired warden of Huntsville Prison was being interviewed, and the BBC interviewer really wanted to pin him down as to the number of executions he had supervised and tried to get some detail about them. But he resisted very politely and very gently, but very firmly. And there was something about that voice, the gentleness and the firmness, that I recognized from living in Texas for a number of years, and it haunted me. It even perhaps became a kind of familiar, a voice that I would hear in my head. I'd internalized it.
Here's Avril Curdy reading To the Voice of the Retired Warden of Huntsville Prison, Texas Death Chamber. It begins with the speaker trying to get to sleep while listening to the radio.
Until wolf-light, I will count my sheep. Adumbrated, uncomedic as they are. One is Purdue, two, qualm, three is sprawl, four, too late, night is already a thirsty county in Texas, salt flat and unremitting blacktop as dry as my mouth, and your elastic vowels, my genial, my electric ghost, my radio's lonely station. Because the spectacle of suffering corrupts us, all punishments are now executive, off stage. Most presume you a fable, echoes of approaching boot heels that hairy labyrinths of concrete corridors, or hooded in burlap. We are convicted as we are also pardoned. He cherished his lawn, or afterwards he covered the victim's face. You make no judgments yourself. Only in bursal tones, tactful as the file box that shows, if opened, the neon pleading heart of Jesus wrapped in barbed wire, you perform penalties others have scripted, so untroubled by so many. How long I have listened to you for news of the opal distances or rain to freshen the morning's arrival. What keeps me awake? Nothing more than a fly's dysenteric violin. What puts me to sleep is your clement voice saying the dark has no teeth. While men like you live in this world, do I dream I am either safe or spared?
That's a very beautiful, powerful poem, I think. I especially admire the way that she moves from these visceral details, very specific things, which she controls musically. In your elastic vowels, my genial, my electric ghost, my radio's lonely station. It's beautifully played out into a generalization that the poem legitimately makes, and it includes all of us. Because the spectacle of suffering corrupts us, all punishments are now executive off stage.
Yeah. The language here is fascinating because the poem seems to absorb voices from this hypnagogic state, the state of being asleep or falling asleep or hearing other voices. And it does that without being abstract, and it doesn't lose track of reality. So the poem talks about the echoes of approaching boot heels that harry labyrinths of concrete corridors. I mean, that's exactly what we imagine, I don't know, from movies and TV shows, but the echoing footsteps in the prison leading to the death chamber.
Yeah.
So it's got that kind of dream language that she's interrogating. You know, do I trust this voice? Do I trust what is behind this voice, the authority behind it?
What keeps me awake? Nothing more than a fly's dysenteric violin. What puts me to sleep is your clement voice saying the dark has no teeth. While men like you live in this world, do I dream I am either safe or spared?
The poem ends on this paradox, what amounts to a kind of grotesque lullaby almost, is it's this voice. You know, she counts her sheep with the voice. And she says,
calls it a clement
exactly,
voice. Exactly. So there's no clemency, which is what you wait for, you know, in real life, but also the movies, our sense of it is you wait for the governor's phone call for the reprieve to grant clemency.
I mean, what he says, this is the way that it moves in and out of this dream state, is because what puts me to sleep is your clement voice saying something, of course, no voice is ever going to say in reality. The dark has no teeth.
Yeah.
That forbidding statement and very beautiful statement.
Yeah.
Michael Hoffman's selected poems has just been published this spring by Ferrer, Strauss, and Giroux. Hoffman is a poet and a critic. He divides his time between Germany and Florida, and his father was a famous German novelist, Gert Hoffman. We've run a lot of Michael's reviews over the years and have one forthcoming, as a matter of fact, and also have a review of his selected poems forthcoming.
We have two of his new poems in the issue this month. We're going to hear a longer one entitled Portrait d'une Femme. It's a pre-owned title, as it were. Pound used it.
And so did T.S. Eliot. And given the pedigree, you'd expect a sort of biting portrait of a woman of status. And that is, in fact, what we get in this poem.
The type is someone who manages to look after themselves.
Yet Hoffman's femme is a product of the contemporary culture of grievance.
There are these aggrieved people who do spectacularly well, who kind of bed themselves in their grievance.
Hoffman also says that the tone of his poem may have partly come from Thomas Bernhardt, the Austrian novelist and master of invective, who he's been translating.
And we'll hear him read it in just a second. There are some things that may help as you go through. A maenad, he mentions in here, and that's a female follower of Dionysus. Bridget Jones, I'm sure you all know who Bridget Jones. Margaret Cook. You know who Margaret Cook is, Don?
No.
I think it's a contemporary. I know that there's a Margaret Cook who writes for the New Statesman. I don't know if that's who he means, or if there's a more famous Margaret Cook. A Marshall stack? You know what that is?
Mm-mm. Oh, a Marshall stack, yeah. A stack of amplifiers.
I knew you would know that, if anybody
I was trying to think if there was some guy named Marshall Stack.
Right. The poem also has a reference to Anna Magnani, who's a famous Italian actress, whose most famous movie was, I believe, The Rose Tattoo.
The poem has two epigraphs. The first is from Pound. It's from Hugh Selwyn Mauberly. The age demanded an image of its accelerated grimace. And the second is from Bob Dylan. Idiot wind, blowing every time you move your teeth.
Here's Michael Hoffman.
Portrait d'une femme. You are energized by your epoch. The difference between a harmless nut, John Doe, Jane Doe, plain Jane, practically any mediocrity, standing on a beach, and the same harmless nut riding a wave of now cultural self-righteousness about to tube. A tsunami armed with thunderbolts. Empowered, yea, packing. You played everything to the sympathetic studio theatre of your heroes, a chorus cum sounding board. They were your doo-wop boys and girls, your clique and clack and Marshall stack. The church hall chairs scraped, the cheap black crepe backdrop rustled cutting edge at you. You paid attention to how they oohed and aahed for you, and then pantomime hissed and balled their fists and bayed for blood. The half-lustful, half-men, betraying their half-gender when they weren't speculating what you were like in bed. The frightened girls who'd never seen anything like you but thought it might be fun, after goth, to be a maenad. The pharisaic mothers going home to their chilly fires, their dim, furtive, put-upon husbands and their neo-feral offspring, with a "there but for the grace of God" on their bony lips. And it was all you, the decisive impulse, the focus, the leadership. Why, there was the beef, right there, with its bleeding foot in its mouth. The venomous articulation with its trademark solecisms. Naive to wonder how anyone with a Cambridge degree in it could hurt the language like you. A sort of chronically over-emphatic sub-style of maimed English. A testosterone debris of nursery babble, pop psychology, tabloid yelp and obscenity. Strangers were helpless in its vortices. Lawyers, needless to say, loved it. What they would have given, blood, to be able to solicit like that. It was all as humdrum as graffiti, vivid and appalling and unutterably humdrum. It was Mary Elizabeth Bott in the William books going, "I'll thqueam and thqueam and thqueam." It's strange, you were ungainly, but you were never wrong. You had the yeses and nodders and eggers on to take care of that. Ungainliness in this instance happened to be the price of rightness. You espoused ungainliness, worshipped it. Ungainliness was the new duty, the new beauty. Disinhibition ruled. Wahey. And so it somehow had to be. You did it for them. You erupted out of Englishness and made an exhibition of yourself. Tiny Terremoto in Derby that I read about in Mexico. 2-point-something on the Richter scale. Once it might have been said where you came from, you forgot yourself. But that style of rebuke went out of fashion. Anyway, you weren't into forgetting yourself. You were into remembering yourself, as you would have said, 24/7. It would have been good to do smolder like Anna Magnani, or have a wronged profile like Dante's, whoever the fuck Dante is. But you couldn't hack that. So you chucked glasses and went public. Bridget Jones, thuggy. Jordan, tragedienne. The English rose goes ape. Deal or no deal. You were good value at cocktail parties for about 5 minutes. Then you were a bore. And as the good book didn't say, the bores are always with us. You would have loved a column like Margaret Cook, not a cooking column. Your mother was dead. Your godmother was dead. Look what happened to them. They died. Perhaps there was something you could do. And so you stayed alive and humbly served the numpties.
That was Michael Hoffman reading Portrait d'une Femme. Of course, since this is a highbrow podcast, we had to ask Michael if it was a portrait of any particular woman.
I think it's half real and half imaginary, but I'm being elusive.
Yeah, he is being elusive, isn't he? That's what every poet says.
Except the person he wrote this poem about or to would know, I betcha.
Yeah, probably so. But maybe they'll never see it, hopefully. You have to ask yourself, what does a poem like this add? You know, it comes with a title that's been used before by two of the most famous poets of the 20th century. And it seems to me, if you think of Pound, your mind and you are our Sargasso Sea, isn't the way that opens?
Yeah, that's right. And the Sargasso Sea is full of wrecks and artifacts.
Right.
Great blank spaces.
And this poem is so aggressively of the moment. And what the poem does such a good job of, I think, is giving you a sense of this woman and this culture. And what Michael is so good at is you could take just a line like a sort of chronically over-emphatic sub-style of maimed English, a testosterone debris of nursery babble, pop psychology, tabloid yelp, and obscenity.
Well, he's talking about somebody he says hurts the language, which hurts him, and the language that he uses to kind of counteract this or to be tossed back in this person's face is filled with hurtful things.
But you assume it's her language, like 24/7, right?
These right, things, yeah.
Deal or no deal. These things that come out of pop culture.
Yeah. And yet, you know, poetry has many weapons in its arsenal, and some of them are seldom used anymore. You know, we think of most poems as being kind of lyric poems, and this is a poem of real invective. There's real hurt and anger in this poem, and it does that kind of thing only a poem can do. It's kind of an incantation or magic spell. It's
Yeah, it's interesting.
But the stake in the heart of this one.
Well, the stake in the heart is right, but he reads it so softly and so gently. It's a very smooth stake he's sliding in there.
It's part of his slyness.
That's right. Also in the June issue, we have an essay about the Anglo-American poet Tom Gunn, who died in 2004.
The essay in poetry is by Tom Slay. It comes from a longer essay, which will be in a book called At the Barriers, on the poetry of Tom Gunn, which will be published this summer by the University of Chicago Press.
Yeah, and that book is edited by Joshua Weiner. Tom Slay is a poet who teaches at Hunter College in New York, and he joins us by phone from Massachusetts. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Don. How are you?
Good. Tom, the thing about Tom Gunn that we sort of inherit is this idea that he, you know, was an English formal poet who is educated in the canon, and then he goes to California and takes drugs and goes to orgies and becomes something else entirely. Is that accurate?
The best way I can answer the question is once a new formalist wrote him asking if he would contribute to an anthology that they were doing, and he wrote them back and said that he thought that they should be reading Allen Ginsberg. And at the same time, there would be other people who were further out on the aesthetic spectrum than that, and they would write to Tom, and he actually was not much interested in what they were doing either. Tom was a kind of writer who took each poem and poet kind of individually. But in terms of his, you know, being a transplant to California, I think it meant a huge amount to him. It opened up a lot of subject matter for him, and I think in that way, you're absolutely right. There was a huge transformation.
Well, to give listeners who may not know Tom Gunn very well a taste of his work, let's just listen to him read one poem. This poem is called Moly, and it's a dramatic monologue in the voice of one of Odysseus' sailors. And Moly is a magical herb given to Odysseus, which enabled him to ward off the effects of Circe, who was turning the sailors into pigs. But the speaker of this poem is still suffering the effects of her transforming him into another creature, a swine. Here's Tom Gunn reading Moly.
Nightmare of beasthood, snorting, how to wake. I woke. What beasthood skin she made me take. Leathery toad that ruts for days on end, or cringing, dribbling dog, man's servile friend, or cat that prettily pounces on its meat, tortures it hours, then does not care to eat. Parrot, moth, shark, wolf, crocodile, ass, flea. What germs, what jostling mobs there were in me. These seem like bristles, and the hide is tough. No claw or web here, each foot ends in hoof. Into what bulk has method disappeared? Like ham, streaked. I'm gross, grey, gross, flap-eared. The pale, lashed eyes, my only human feature. My teeth tear, tear. I am the snouted creature that bites through anything, root, wire, or can. If I was not afraid, I'd eat a man. Oh, a man's flesh already is in mine, hand and foot poised for risk, buried in swine.
That was Tom Gunn reading very powerfully and beautifully his poem, Moly. Tom Slay, this poem has been read as a sort of veiled description of a drug-induced trip. Do you see it that way?
Well, yes, I do. I mean, it's not simply that.
Yeah, it's a little reductive to think of it just like that, I guess.
Yeah, I remember having a conversation with Tom once about drugs, and it's not that Tom didn't believe that drugs were a certain kind of heightened intensity, heightened consciousness, and it's not that he didn't have a kind of romantic sense of experience, and I think drug use was part of that romance. He had a kind of communitarian ethos that drugs inspired. He thought that they were not only a way to have fun, and he always thought that they were a way to have fun. That was, you know, primary. But they also taught you a lot of interesting things about yourself. And I remember him talking about, you know, first time he was on acid. And he said that the acid experience was very, very valuable to him because he learned all kinds of, as he said, rather unpleasant things about himself. Well, at the same time, you know, it opened him up in lots of ways as a human being. And I think that risk and adventure were prime virtues for Tom. And I think that this poem has a wider understanding than a sort of coterie poem written for fellow drug users. I mean, that's one of the things I love about Tom's language in his poems, is there's a kind of objectivity about it. It's language that is always social. It's language, in a certain sense, that's aware that other people who are not in the club are going to be reading it. And he's very generous to his readers in that way.
Well, if Tom Gunn was one of our great poets of risk and eros, this kind of adventurousness became deadly in his own time, as it continues to be in ours, with AIDS. So how do you think that the AIDS epidemic changed Gunn's hopes that sex and adventure could change everyday life?
I remember talking to Tom about this, and Tom had no settled opinions on these matters, you know. I mean, his opinions were always changing. And I think what he said that is, even though AIDS came along in a certain sense destroyed, you know, a kind of cultural moment, in his great poem Saturday Night, which is about going to the barracks, which is a peculiarly famous sex club, it's a poem that's written in terza rima because he was reading Dante at the time, and of course there's something Dantesque about the experience, not that it's an inferno, but it also leads up to a kind of paradisal state. But the poem does end with the sense that the barracks does burn down and that a certain cultural moment is past, but the kind of ideals that that cultural moment summarized for Tom, something about the grass paradisal state that wisdom points us away from. You know, Tom was very much interested in that ascent to a paradisal state still being a possibility, even if in the world, given the kind of social conditions that AIDS created and that the commodification of drugs created, nonetheless, that was still a real human possibility, and it heartens me to think about Tom in that way, because, you know, both liberals and conservatives have put down drug use as a kind of, you know, self-indulgence, and I've always thought that that was, you know, a rather partial, easy way to dismiss a certain kind of experience that Tom valued highly and that, frankly, I think was tremendously important.
Well, picking up on that, you also talk in your essay about one of the things that's so original in Tom Gunn's love poetry is the way that he makes pleasure and eroticism and domestic stability all parts of a single continuum. And that's also a very controversial notion among certain people. And I wonder if you could speak to that and then also if you can think of any straight poets who do something similar.
To tell you the truth, Chris, I can't think of any male poet who puts domesticity and eroticism and a sense of continuity together. They're always antithetical, in fact. You know, the whole troubadour tradition, it's always about the lady who can't be attained, whereas with Tom, eros and friendship were on a kind of seamless continuum. You know, I remember going to visit Tom once at his house in the Haight, and Tom came down the stairs and he opened the door, and on the wall there were many, many, many old thermometers collected from old gas stations and whatnot. And then I went up the stairs and there was, you know, collections of figurines. And Tom just said to me, well, you know, all my housemates, they collect things. And I said, well, what do you collect, Tom? He said, well, I collect housemates who collect things. And we both laughed. But what I was struck by was just the familiarity of the domesticity. You know, Tom lived with the same housemates for over 30 years. Every night, one of them would cook a different meal, and people were expected to be home for meals. I mean, there was a whole web of love and familial relations which they developed among themselves. And even though Tom, you know, lived with Mike Ty for most of his life, obviously they had different adventures with other people. And one of the things that I love in Tom's work is he's got a beautiful poem called The Hug, which is just so touching in that at the end of the poem, his partner hugs him from behind, and he says that it was not sex. He says, in which our grand passion had not yet become familial. But the transition from passion to the familial, if there's a touch of regret, there's also a kind of triumph there.
You've written about poets who are ill. You've written about things in your own life and about Robert Duncan.
Yeah.
When it comes to Tom Gunn, what can you tell us about the way his poems intersect with what happened to the people around him and to him?
Well, I remember sitting around on the couch with Tom talking, and he said, well, you know, I began to write this poem about a friend of mine who died, and it was a very good place to put my grief. I found that so touching and affecting and breaks down the barriers between life and art. while at the same time, anyone who reads like Lament, which is a very beautiful poem and couplet, it's one of the great elegies, I think, for that era, maybe, you know, one of the great elegies I've ever read. And the poems that were in The Man from Night Sweats always had that kind of beautiful particularity about one person facing their illness and what it was to them. And he had a beautiful way of being able to keep himself out of the poem, and that was part of his tact, I think. He always finds ways in the poems to acknowledge the limits of his own subjectivity. And that, to me, was a great kind of moral stance, although Tom would, you know, laugh at me if I said moral stance. I mean, and morals were extremely important to Tom, but not in any kind of absolute way. They were always situational, relational, you know, and they were always changing.
Well, thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Don.
Thanks, Tom. Tom Slay's most recent book of poems, Spacewalk, won the 2008 Kingsley Tufts Award.
You can read Tom Slay's essay about sex, drugs, and Tom Gunn, and everything else you've heard on this program in the June issue of Poetry Magazine, and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman, edited by Sarah Campbell, and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherer.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.